introduce ourselves?
I'm Peter Williams from Delaware. I teach at the University of Delaware, and I'm here for 3 months on an artist residency.
My name is Lena Mion. I am a native of New Orleans. I am an art curator and an educator here in New Orleans.
My name is Chloe Sanetian. I'm an emerging artist in residence in the city. New Orleans local.
My name's Erica Christmas. I've been in the city for about a year now, and I run a small publishing press in this district.
Okay, so we have these cards with questions and discussion points. Most of them are about Black issues, local issues, post-Katrina issues, and art-related issues. Mm-hmm. This is an easy one. Discuss the impact of the tourist economy on the cultural economy. Mm. Maybe it's not so easy.
That's for you guys.
Well, I would say not enough tourists get to actually experience the culture of New Orleans. For example, I have several friends that are, one here in the room at another table, he wants to start his own company as it relates to the African American and African history of New Orleans that is not told the way it's supposed to be told. There are a couple African American tourists here, but if you've ever been on it or if you've ever researched it, they're very much so watermelon. So certain things are needed, as well as in the CVB, they don't reach out to most of the cultural institutions. You have to literally stumble upon a native that will tell you where to go for you to visit the McKenna Museum or the museum,
yeah.
Or Mardi Gras Indian Museum. I think it's called House of Golden Feather. Now I see our culture being assimilated a lot more, and it bothers me. I was driving, picking up Prince from uptown, and they had these men in kilts, but then they had all kinds of second line regalia. And I was absolutely confused by how is that a connection. And also, I was offended because it's not your culture just to play with. You're not connected with this spiritually. I mean, I am very much so. I'm thinking of the proper word, but if any of you share any type of culture, I'm very close to it, and I am a protector of it,
yeah.
And I don't like to see it used in any kind of way. So now the others, for lack of a better word, are having their own second lines, and their own Mardi Gras Indians, and their own marching bands, and it does not belong to them, and it is very much so bothersome to me. So yeah, I feel like those people who are already in position making the money, they are assimilating our culture so the money can stay with them.
Yeah.
They'll recommend them to something that's supposed to be cultural, and it's not really cultural.
Were you referring to the Irish parade last night? When did you say
you
saw
it? No, this is today. Like 2 hours
okay.
ago, I went to pick up our prints,
okay.
And I'm driving, and I was like,
because there was a little parade in the French Quarter last night,
yeah,
and
right.
there were people in like straw skirts, like green and orange colors with straw skirts and sweatshirts that said Irish Zulu.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
That was so horrible.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
For instance, the second time for, what's his name?
David Bowie?
Oh yeah. Well, that was just...
It wasn't really a second line. It was just like people walking.
Well, I mean, just growing up here, the first impact that I sensed of the tourist economy on the cultural economy, like, Mardi Gras has always been PG. Like, if it's the family, I grew up as a child, I never saw boobs everywhere. Like, it was a family event. Yeah.
That's why.
Yeah. Well, I mean, well, my family, we grew up in Algiers, so we're very suburban. And I don't know, whenever I traveled and people, yeah, Namtok got a little turn, but.
Namtok didn't get very turned.
No.
I marched it with my school, so.
But I don't know, just talking to relatives from out of town about where I live, and they just have certain stereotypes about it.
What, as it relates to Algiers or just New Orleans?
Just New Orleans, like Mardi Gras. And
yeah, the stereotypes are definitely there. I feel like now, post-Katrina, people are, obviously, the lens is on New Orleans now, post-Katrina. Yeah. But before, like being a child, spending half my year in New Orleans, it's been half my year in California. I hated California because no one could relate to me. My hair, the way I looked, the way I spoke, the way I talked. You know, who are you?
What?
You look this way, you look that way. And I was tortured in California because I wasn't quite, you know, Latina, and I wasn't mixed black and white. And they're like, okay, we can't really pinpoint you. And at the time, I didn't really know what I was. I know now.
Was this from the general community or other African American students?
School. So the African American students were black and white. I didn't go to school with not one completely African American child. I was a completely African American child. But I know more about my history and my ancestry now. But in my mind, I'm black.
Right.
So I'm black. But you don't really look that.
That's what
I mean, you look this, and why do you sound
that? That's so bizarre to me.
And it's just a lot. And
because appearance here is not that.
Here,
it's so fluid.
Right. We have to tell people, you black, baby.
Yeah.
You tell me.
California,
they were just really confused about
your cheekbones. I don't know what
cheekbones. When I was little, I mean, I had big curly hair right now, straightened, but I had big curly hair. Of course, I had a strong New Orleans accent as a child.
Yeah.
Because I went and came back and forth. And I didn't really kick it. I mean, if I'm around my family, you hear it, but usually that's not the way I speak at the time. Certain words, yes, but not. So yeah, I saw that a lot when.
But you also maintain a strong presence, I sense.
Yeah.
Because the vibe I pick up is like, this is
I've
a
always
serious
been,
person.
Yeah, but I've always had a very strong spiritual presence with me too. And I think it comes from being here.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So,
oh, absolutely.
I was never just the surface child, but.
That's a good segue to this.
Me as an artist, leave it alone.
Can I just comment one thing about the? There's I was looking online. These images of this one white woman had. This was like a hipster, but she had this shirt that said "No gentrification," but instead "regeneration." So there's this new. It's like, oh, this is a new word for this thing now.
Yeah.
Oh, it's the flip side of gentrification.
They're just flipping it. Yeah.
So now we're just flipping it. We're gonna give it this brand new word. And it's gonna sound really. It was like respect locals. Regeneration, not regentrification.
But it's code.
It's for the same.
It's the same thing, just different things.
And then this idea of like I can be Irish and come into town and I'm gonna have an Irish student.
Yeah.
Like. And it's like this idea, like, you're in this place of privilege where it's like, oh, I'm going to tell myself that I'm going to do it, I'm paying homage.
No, you're really not, you're just taking it.
Yeah.
Can you afford to be offended by that because they're bringing in tourist dollars?
But where's that money going toward? Yeah, that's what it's always been about, milling people into the city to bring in money, but the money is going to...
But that's the obligation of the city people to find the avenues and the funding to make those kind of changes. So you don't want to get rid of the funding or the money.
I think the problem, though, is that the lens focus is on, like, just in infrastructure, rebuilding the city. There are certain parts of the city that are completely ignored. Streets aren't being paved, and it's because that's not where they're bringing the tourists.
Well, what are people doing to make that happen? I mean, I'm afraid to sort of say it because I'm an outsider. But, you know, it seems to me that some of the empowerment has got to be on the backs of local people.
Yeah.
You know, that they've got to find a way to make that work for them in a positive way and also to build up an identity.
it's a financial situation as well. For instance, I was having dinner by myself at a bar, and there was a white gentleman that stared at me, and he, I don't have to say why. But then he ended up coming sit with me, asked me to buy a drink, and did that whole setup. But long story short, he said, oh, I just bought two shotgun houses near the fairgrounds. I already have two houses at Bayou St. John. What is it like to have such a French culture?
Blasphemous. What's it like to have such a French culture?
So after I chewed him out about this French culture, yeah. We talked about gentrification. And he said, the real estate is so cheap. You know, we just come from up north with all our money and buy up everything.
Yeah, you just
it's a financial thing. Because in my mom's neighborhood, she lives in the 7th Ward down the street. And she rents. And now, within those two blocks before you hit Paris Avenue, it's probably like 7 white people, not even families. Like it looks like a single man or a single woman or a couple. And they buy them and they renovate these homes. So now it's a very mixed neighborhood. And a lot of people are moving out and you can't afford it anymore, because if they rent it, they're going to jack up the price.
And that's not a choice of the community members. Those are literally real estate people.
And like we were talking about this in the earlier group about how like you have some of these people who are persons of color, African Americans, who've owned homes for years, who are being like constantly accosted by like these hedge fund people to like sell their homes, be like, oh, I'll give you $5 million for a house that you bought for less than that. And it's like it's kind of like a gray area. It's like, what do you do? It's like you want financial stability. You want to get out of your position. You want to kind of move up and ascend. But also too, it's like if you do that, not only are like you leaving your presence is leaving the neighborhood, but then God knows who else is going to come in and replace that. And then usually it's going to be an Airbnb or, you know.
He told me this. He said, it's not that, you know, we're taking your culture or we are assimilating your culture. We're just making it our own. It does not belong to you.
You can't take someone's culture. That's the thing that it's like, you can't take it.
And their minds, they think they're coming in. Because there was white people who lived here. They did their thing, but the Africans, we always did our thing. And the great thing about New Orleans is that they, Africans were still able to practice that culture. And that's why.
And there's a history, unlike the rest of the U.S., where free people of color were living and owning land and miscegenating legally. Because
that's most of our family stories.
Yeah.
It's crazy to me because I used to live on St. Ferdinand and North Roman, like past the overpass. It's kind of far out. And when I first moved there, everybody was like, oh, what are you doing? Like, you're crazy. Like, that area is like really, really sketchy. It's dangerous. And I was like, whatever. And I actually really grew to love the neighborhood. Like, I knew all my neighbors, like, talked to them frequently, like, every day. And then, like, right around when I moved out, it was like people were calling it the New Marigny. I saw the New Marigny. People were like jogging, people were like pushing baby strollers, fucking walking their dogs, like being really
German
rude.
Shepherds.
Yeah, exactly, being really rude, not saying hi to you when they walk past you, not saying hi to you, looking at you like you're crazy. And like, I was like, what? And then like, I was talking to a friend of mine, they're like, oh yeah, like they're planning to like redo that area over completely because it's so close to St. Claude. And so it just broke my heart. And then like five of my neighbors ended up actually selling their houses. Because they got offers and all the houses on the street, they flipped.
Just to keep the questions rolling, I think these are two good segues. What keeps you in New Orleans? Are you from here? Why do you stay? And I think also we should think about this one, which is Beyonce's use of Katrina and Messy Maya. Problematic. Intellectual and cultural copyrights of the city.
I've already talked about
Beyonce. I'm from here. I'm not always going to stay, but I know I want to grow old here, and I'm always going to come back. And I think her use, it was just random to me.
It was just problematic. It was just disrespectful.
The flood, I was like, to me it was like, clearly Beyonce as an artist is infatuated with New Orleans.
Is like her first pro-black song, but I mean, like Yonsei, that whole album was, she was still like, she wasn't taking anyone else's identity, but
yeah,
this was a point where she just played up an image, and I don't know if it was a creative team decision or,
because I don't listen to Beyonce. I have probably like 5 total Beyonce songs of her whole entire career.
Yeah.
I'm just not really connected to her in any kind of way. But what I was offended by the flood scene. I lived in Atlanta at the time, so I was not here, but my family came to me and I had 9 people in a 2-bedroom apartment. So yeah, my brother was missing with his children for a few days. So yeah, we all went through it. But I was talking to my friend, someone that works with us at Studio B, and he said, you know what, he was a senior in high school. He said, I never thought about what we went through during Katrina until I saw that video. And he was in New Orleans East, and his auntie had 3 levels. So they were at the 3rd level. Like, you know how sometimes the 3rd floor is smaller? And he and his whole family and extended family were up there stuck because his great aunt was very ill and she could not, she couldn't leave. So he said, I didn't think about it until I saw that video.
Yeah,
I mean,
you just use this image of, like, it's not, first of all, it's 10 years ago. It's not yours.
Yeah.
Mind you, Creole and Negro, there is no separation. So I don't have a problem with her loving our city. I mean, it's a spiritual place. So many people come here and just fall in love. I get it. And this is a city you actually can fall for. But at least do your research.
Yeah.
That's the least you can do.
It's like, she's a global figure. And
yeah,
this
she
is
has
like,
the money to do her research and get those articles.
You're kind of some people.
Did no one go like, maybe that image, maybe that image. I know a lot of people are like, first of all, why are you bringing that up 10 years? This is 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Like, what's the
And
like,
just the visual of her on the car, it's so romanticized. I just thought about all the violence that happened in the Superdome, and like, that's a stark contrast from what you're showing us.
Yeah.
And the water was clear. That was the worst part for me. Like, the water was murky. It was not clean water.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's all just
types of massage. Well, are people producing their own documents?
No, I mean, there was the right after Katrina, Spike Lee did.
Why isn't that being publicized or making an attempt to take ownership more of one's own identity?
Mm. We do have cultural workers here in the city, cultural producers who are working to tell our own story.
Oh.
But it's a finance issue as well. Mm. So we only can go so far. I mean, this is a great way to segue in Lydia. And she can introduce herself and tell about some of the stuff she does even when she's eating.
Oh, okay. Well, my name is Lydia Nichols. I'm from Atlanta. I went to middle school with Chloe.
Aww.
I don't know y'all, but I'm
it's all good.
In 10 years, we might be sitting at another table. I feel like I knew them that one time. Anyway, I'm from here as well. Work that I do, I never know how to talk about it.
I'm speaking of Katrina babies.
Oh, the Katrina baby stuff. So yeah. So a friend of mine is producing a documentary film about the children of Katrina. people who were young at the time and their experiences. I am working on sort of a more scholarly, less just documentary book that is an anthology of work. I'm going to say it in the terms I use in grant writing, grant proposals. An anthology of work by emerging Black scholars and cultural producers who were under 16 and living in New Orleans at the time of Katrina, about how we relate to the idea of home, given our dual displacement as diasporic Africans and as, that's some of the work I do, and I also do some curatorial stuff, and I write for Pelican Bob, which is a local art group publication. I'm a critic.
This is sort of going with what you're talking about right now. Discuss support systems for your work, commercial, community, institutional, governmental, if there are any.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, that's what I'm struggling
with. Sometimes it's,
you know.
In New Orleans, it's
It's dry territory. I know for myself, I mean, I'm here at residency, so I feel like I've got some support, and I also teach, so I've got some support there to a degree. I also apply for grants and various kinds of things in Detroit that dealt with community activity and projects with the auto companies and so forth to find different pathways to getting money or funding or things of that sort for the projects that I tried to initiate. And some were successful, some weren't. I think, again, part of it is sort of recognizing that if you don't ask, you don't get. And that you really got to be prepared to ask again and again and not let that interference sort of get in the way of your production. And then find alternative kinds of methods to expedite that. Like I use my artwork as a kind of tool function for my ideas and questions about race and identity, rather than just making decorative kinds of things, which is nothing wrong with that. But for myself, I think one of the tasks that I defined for myself was bearing witness. And that gave me a model to apply for grants and things of that sort as I went out into the world. So I think self-initiation, I know it's impossible and hard, but it's something that you can't give up.
Well, to speak on that, I mean, I agree with you in like a lot of senses, like taking the initiative and like reaching out to people, emailing people is really good. And I do that myself. Like I run a pretty small like publishing press. I put out prints and zines and other types of artist objects. And I work with other artists as well collaboratively. And then for my day job, I usually either do nannying or like assistant work. But I don't know, I find that like, that it could still be pretty hard, even if you are like reaching out to people. Because I feel like this is, it's all about the capital these days. It's all about the money. It's all about like, can you put down to produce these many objects in like this much amount of time? And I feel like that's just my frustration right now, is that like I've been emailing people. Luckily, being in New Orleans, like New Orleans has introduced me to so many lovely people who have connected me to really great resources and have given me the opportunity to show my work in different types of spaces. But I don't know. I mean, it might just be because like I am kind of used to that like New York flow of things, like how things sort of come like really, really fast. And like here it's more of like a kind of like a simmering fire type of thing. But I don't know. I mean, I guess, I don't know. I mean, maybe that's just my frustrations, but I feel like it's just like a little bit more than just like emailing people. Like I feel like this is what I'm trying to figure out right now.
And it has gotten a few days. I'll talk about that and talking about what I was gonna say. I feel like in New Orleans, because our culture is so sort of like what's the word? To some extent I'd say fetishized. It's really hard to do things that are not the things we do. Like, if you're not, like, Mardi Gras Indians will always have fun day. Because, they're, like, there are certain things that will always have fun day. And if you're trying to do something that is more sort of doing and not non-traditional, you're going to have difficulty getting funding. So, like, my philosophy in the projects that I've worked on and produced has been, I invest whatever I can and hope for the best. So, like, with Exhibit B, we didn't have any money until the, like, week before we opened. All the pain, everything, that, like, we put it up. And I was coming back and forth from Atlanta, because I was living there at the time, like, and it wasn't a thing. None of us got paid.
But it was also a private funder. It didn't come from any grant writing.
And we was
written any grants, too, but we didn't get them.
But isn't some of that a byproduct of, and I don't mean to sound condescending, but you, you know, that I'm 64. And I can think back to when I first started to originate projects with my friends, exhibitions, things of that sort. I didn't know exactly, and we didn't know exactly what kind of avenues we needed to travel. But in hindsight, I think one of the assets that came out of it was that trial and error, you began to succeed. And began to see that there was an opening, at least to make the attempt worthy of the time that you were invested. And then I had to learn other tools, like computers and so forth, to make it more possible to communicate with other organizations. But after looking back over 40 years of doing this, you know, you start to sort of begin to sort of say, wow, there was a kind of productivity that came out of that knowledge that I didn't have, because I didn't know better. If I had known better, I would have done it. One of the experiences that I embraced was my ignorance and allowed that to push forward into other kinds of solutions.
I think we, all three of us, myself, Lydia, and Brandon learned a lot during the process. I would say our biggest drawback was our short amount of time that we had to get this project done, because we started in May and we opened in November, and we applied for like three or four grants in between. And I will also speak to the fact that they didn't see it. And with the success of Exhibit B,
I'm speaking specifically about the city. Even posting this huge art event, tens of thousands of people came.
Internationally.
Over the course of 3 months, international visitors. And afterwards, Brandon reached out to them about doing along top of tools, because it's just these lame brain
models.
And they were like, no, like, unless it's going to be like some, well, the caveat was like, if it's going to be some, like, a second one, I'm creating it like a second one. So that's what I'm talking about. So I say they do not fund things that are not
traditional. Yeah.
What they promote for tourist purposes. Like, yeah. Because that's tourist stuff. I mean,
speaking of.
Yep. Are these people of color?
Some of them, yeah.
And that they'll support you on a personal level.
Yeah.
But once they're
separation. So, like, them funneling institutional support.
So there's an educational process that they need to go through. And how do you begin to sort of serve that?
We've been trying to figure that out for
them. In a way that's viable. You know, with a long-term goal and short-term goals along the way.
Well, it's hard because the city is already very invested in a tourist community.
That's our money maker.
Trying to ignore voices. So it's like the city, it's like you have all the money, but your concern is about all these other people who don't actually live here, who have no stake here, because that's who you're being curious. So it's, I feel like for me, it turns into a very like big discussion about how we make money, how the city makes money. Like, the public affairs office is funded by parking tickets. Like, that's how the DA is funded, is through these parking tickets that we get. So, it's just the economy is But we got that because we're working Welcome Table is basically the city initiative to gather mixed race groups of people in each neighborhood, and they convene on a regular basis for racial reconciliation. So they just like have conversations that aren't even really like facilitated or like guided or like.
That's an interesting initiative.
They just like what? They just talk. So anyway, works for me because I got $50,000 for a project, not for me. I wish. Wouldn't that be nice if we were making like the right amount of money for the level of work that
we do?
Right.
Yeah,
it would
be great.
The standard of excellence that we consistently meet, but you know, a girl can dream. Anyway,
are there regional foundations?
So the Kellogg Foundation is funding Welcome to. So the city got $500,000 from Kellogg, and then they invited Welcome Table to each of them to pitch a project to them. And so they reached out to us, and I developed the curriculum, and like, yeah, so it's like $50,000 from Kellogg. And the city consistently gets money from like Kellogg and Ford specifically. But, you know, it doesn't really go to the people most times. You know, they have, one of the things that really disturbs me, I feel like I have to mention this, and it's kind of non sequitur, but those, you know, those electrical things in the NutriGround?
The boxes?
They've been painted. They're aesthetically terrible. Like, on a technical level, they're terrible.
Wasn't it an open call though? Like, was
yeah,
it?
Yeah, was like open submission.
I wasn't sure how. I know some African American artists who, I don't remember the open call, but I know other African American artists who reached out but didn't get chosen.
Yeah, it was just based on proposals.
Yeah, there's like one I'm like, oh, that one.
That one's
sometime, but otherwise.
Or, and they're also not responsive to the community.
There's so much history in all these neighborhoods. I live in Gentilly. I've been in Gentilly most of my life. So when I see them painted, and it's a pelican.
Or
have a magnolia.
Yes.
Like, do you even know the history of this particular neighborhood? Like, you didn't do any research. You just went up there and wanted to paint something pretty. Or what the Wikipedia says about New Orleans. Yeah. Oh, our bird is pelican, our flower is magnolia, our tree is. And that's what I felt like was done.
Yeah.
You never consulted the natives, people who've been in that community for years. I mean, the Milne family, or the fact that it used to be a swamp, or just nothing.
Detroit had the highest rate of abandoned skyscrapers probably in the United States, and the advocacy group started posting and printing on buildings destroyed by neglect, and they started to get such a level of publicity that internationally people were photographing and participating in group actions, documenting this, humiliating the city fathers for not taking responsibility for those kinds of things. I wonder if one of the things that could be considered would be those kinds of ACT UP moments where people take back the night, so to speak, you know, and reconfigure things like that are offensive, don't really rally people around the history of the neighborhood, and just do it.
We have so much. I love off of Robert E. Lee Boulevard. We just have so much. At the end of the day, cleaning that mess up is. And changing our people. You know, some of them aren't where we are with it. You know, they're, you know.
Oh.
They don't really want to be involved in that. They don't care as long as their family is taken care of. So it's just a lot. It's a lot. Not that we're not up for the fight, because we're doing what we can when we can. It's
right. No, I know. That kind of advocacy is difficult to maintain. I know from, you know, trying to be in my neighborhood a community organizer so I could have a safe neighborhood to live in. And so trying to get people to be involved on a regular basis was problematic. I had to do things like bar up my house to keep it safe.
What does that do for building like a safe space? You know, like if we were to protest those signs, like having some sort of like
conscious, we already have people on the ground.
Yeah.
What is it? Black something, BYB.
Yeah, Black Project. Yeah, Black Youth Project. They're doing something about.
Yeah. Actually, one of my coworkers, he's also a poet in the community, where I call Dust Sleep.
Just wondering if, like, we're talking, you know, like how they put up signs in the skyscrapers, like if the local did something about those boxes, would that be Black and anger, and how would that be met?
By being authentic. You know, I mean, there's nothing wrong with Black anger. We're taught that they're not allowed to be angry. I know teaching at institutions, the worst thing you can do is speak up as a Black, authentic person and have emotions around it. But, you know, I mean, all those people who died from AIDS, you know, finally pushed people to act up and to provide a kind of constituency for the kind of revolutionary actions that they were doing that helped redefine what their goals were. You know, and I think maybe to a certain degree, one doesn't have to violate the neighborhood, but one could begin to sort of find a methodology that would publicize what the concerns are. So that, again, that educational feature begins to play a role in allowing people over time to self-educate. Oh, this group is doing this. Why are they doing that? They're doing this because of X, X, and X. You know, maybe that makes a little sense. Maybe it doesn't. At least you're getting a discussion going on.
That's
only
other things that
But if they're that offensive, you know.
Those who are aware.
Right. Right. How do you make people aware?
How do y'all feel about the artwork? Like the painting of the pillars of the underpass in Treme, those painted pillars.
Yeah, that is
valid.
Yeah, it's old.
The way that it comes in is valid, and the history of that particular neighborhood as well is so rich. So to see it in the condition that it's in, and to know the history of it, it's just...
And the condition that it's in is in part, or largely, not even just in part,
But did you end up trying to tear it down and replant the trees?
But that's because of the white people are coming back and gentrifying, and they want to be able to jog and push their strollers. So,
Six years later,
after you've destroyed this, like, black business corridor, fuck that, who cares? But white people have been here now. So
now it's time to make it pretty.
Okay,
we're going to make it pretty,
So I like grew up sort of in that neighborhood. I would go there every day after school and like sell snacks to the students. It was like a vocational
I think it works. I was just comparing the two.
And I think it was also like people from that neighborhood, and I feel like it might have been more community directed and not like
deal with
Literally fighting for our culture. That's literally what we're doing.
Right.
To keep it, to preserve it.
And also, like, also to like find ways to express it differently outside of like
our
funding. Yeah. If you don't do what's traditional, how do you get, you know, how
problematic?
Yeah. If you're not doing what's already, I mean, they've already gone through this, but that person getting on your balance recognized, which I do believe, it kind of bothers me.
It's like any other like financial instrument.
They used to make this to earn them, and now they're like put in reserves. You know, and it's just like, it's
financial
speculation. They used to burn them?
Yeah,
because they were
like,
they spent all year. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's also wasted. It becomes acceptable when she comes from tourists, and then with action, now that's like the only thing. Like, this is the confines, and you're having something that exists outside of it. We're not going to give you money, but you can do it like you should. And you can also just still have to pay like hundreds to thousands of dollars in permits. Like, you can do that, which would be like just a pretty nice. But we'll come on your stage when you have your biggest event.
You guys need a secret society.
Yeah.
That acts.
No, that's not, I don't think that's a trait. I totally agree.
I agree.
So there's a lot of power in all that. I think a secret society would be great.
Well, you could draw upon the history too, you know, of the uprising in 1811 and other times in which they had a kind of covert activity going on in order to maintain a kind of connectivity to one another. You know, and I think that's part of the condition we're sort of all faced with, in figuring out who the stakeholders really are in a situation of that sort. Because there may very well be non-people of color who also feel
Do y'all want to move on to the next question? I feel like this kind of like ties in with what we're saying. It says, discuss local exhibiting institutions and their engagement with the local creative community and economy.
Let's see.
And their engagement with?
With the local creative community and economy.
This is also from the more museum side of things, from the lens of the museums. And what I've seen, I see that sometimes they branch off a little bit more, but it's usually the same artists that are exhibiting, the same artists that get recognized over and over. It's just that recycling of those same people. Every now and again, they'll let a new person in based on the institutions that we have that exhibits these people, and when they come, you know, it's just like anything else as it relates to entertainment or mixtapes or what have you. You know, when you put yourself out there, you're finally getting the recognition without them. And that art is so great.
Yeah.
How do you know? You know, and there's an institution in particular that I'm completely against and I do not support. I won't pay to go in there. For me, I just don't and I won't because I won't say it on tape. However, you know which one. So I was an intern there and I was the only black person that worked in the office. And I'm getting my master's degree, and many of them didn't have one or were in their programs. I think they only had one graduate student, so nobody had a master's degree but me. And I was finishing it. And to watch them talk about your culture, talk about your African-American artists, and, you know, the way they want to exhibit them, you know, it bothers me when it's problematic. And then when you walk in the space and you're looking at, everything's mixed up, right? Unless it's a specific exhibition, and I can't say anything about the photography, the curator of photography. I think he's amazing as a curator. I might not like all the images, but he's an amazing curator. I was always impressed with his work, but everything else, the way it's set, you're walking through it, and you're like, oh, this is great. And all of a sudden, two paintings down, you're largely offended. Like, how the hell does this fit next to it? I was up there one day, and there was a fish tank? Yeah, it looked like a fish tank. And it was a cotton. And the overseer white man on the horse. And they're like, little army men looking figures, and it's a cotton field. Somebody made it. And they had the gun over the slaves in the cotton field. What made you?
This is gonna like the institution. But that's the problem we have when our chief curator is a white man.
A white man from Mississippi.
I like him as a person.
Yeah, he's cool. He's cool. I spend a lot of time in his office, not like that. But a lot of time in his office working with project administrator. But yeah, they hired me because I was literally, I know that's the reason why they hired me. But they say that something. We never had anything Southern, and oh my God, you're so intellectual. Oh my God, you're so knowledgeable. It's just like, I gotta do this for my grade, so I'm gonna go ahead on and do this. And I had to literally do a project on my internship. You have to literally critique the museum. And it's a book that you have to create. We're critiquing the museum. And I had a whole lot. And the only black people that worked there, by the way, were the security guards that I loved and the janitors that I always gave so much respect to. I won't speak to anybody else.
Endemic to a lot of cultural institutions.
Well, I think also they have an museum of Southern.
Well, that's true. I don't think that makes sense. I work with the board members on the board of Museum Right. That's who I work with. That was a whole other experience as well. But I feel like that should be. That doesn't make sense. The Museum of Southern Art. How are we going to have that existing power? Somebody. Because if you're going from a specific time period,
right,
where there was the lows and then there were the highs, right, and that's literally what you're showing, and that's your bringing that trauma back to those people that we don't always go there. No, we don't really frequent that particular.
Yeah. I think it's important to have an institution like that if it is
done correctly.
Yeah.
Well, how do you feel about the work of Kara Walker? Do you know her work?
Yeah.
Is that offensive? Or?
I have my own issues with Kara. Yeah.
Because it's misogynistic, it's sexist.
Her work has the humor because it's so truthful. Like, that's why I find it so funny.
I find it funny. So, yeah. But I can, hearing what you're saying about work that offends a person's taste.
It would
taste.
Offend me if her work was white. Then it would really offend me.
All right.
But, I mean, she's married to a white man, but
right.
Can still speak to those things. I'm offended by those who don't have a voice.
Yeah. Right.
You don't have a voice to speak to those things. So
right.
Why are you talking?
Yeah.
What are you saying? Are you saying what someone else said and you're interpreting it? I'm kind of confused or how you're connected to this, especially as an artist. A part of us, a part of your being when you're creating.
Because I struggle with that question because of my own work, trying to deal with race and representation through narrative, storytelling, and autobiography. I don't know if I go too far sometimes or not far enough. in regards to it. Because sometimes I take...
As far as you feel that you've done. Because you never know, you know, what is supposed to come out of that. Is that supposed to reach? So, I mean, art is so intuitive. You know, it comes from a spiritual place.
Right, right.
At least after marriage.
Right, right.
So I say keep going. I mean, if it pushes you all the way to go.
I wanted to talk for a brief minute about the art galleries on St. Claude. And well, I know. And like how problematic they are, especially.
Downtown?
Yeah, because they have like an art walk. And yeah, today, ironically. And especially to like talk about, I mean, the print shop. You know where the print shop is? Yeah, and like the lack of actual like community involvement. Despite the fact that the print shop is a predominantly black neighborhood in the Ninth Ward, the print shop, but like they don't, most of the print members don't really care about the kids. They can give a rat's ass. They feel like the kids are bothersome, and there's only like two people within that whole collective that actually want to work with the kids in the neighborhood. And that's what you're thinking about other galleries, such as like Good Children, The Front, like how poisonous it is like for these galleries to be mainly white ran galleries with a white committee and with a white like
educators
members.
Will's attorney,
yeah,
as an educator, because that's how we feel about these white teachers coming in from elsewhere.
Yeah, I feel the same way.
Telling me how to treat.
Yeah,
yeah.
And there's a white teacher at my school that she's just, I know it, she's just something about my presence just bothers her because I wear my blackness all over my shirts, all over everywhere. The way I am with my children, and we both work in a particular section, like a work group. I really don't want to say the name of it, but we work with the kids in the afternoon. And she spent so much time in Kenya, she comes in the African garb.
Oh, Lord. Oh, no. No, no.
And then I have on my melanin shirt, and she looks at me, and you know the job of it. So go ahead. Because what you think you can teach these kids, I can teach them better.
Oh,
and she just really, she never speaks to me. And this is why I go, I can tell you how you're doing. And she won't say it.
Yeah.
I have one thing that she dates at the school. Really different story. He's amazing. Everybody loves him. But, and he's talked to her. You know, none of the teachers, the black teachers around here are comfortable because you don't speak to them.
Yeah.
When you're trying to, and you're teaching
our children.
Yeah.
Trying to provoke some questions.
Yeah.
And answers and ideas.
Yeah.
Oh, Lord.
We do that.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
That's,
I mean,
going to be an ongoing discussion.
Yeah.
I work at a school where we don't have teacher American teachers.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, that's really good. Yeah.
Black teachers, we're probably 70%.
What school do you work at? Okay.
I don't know. It might
keep
it
on
back.
The hush. Okay.
I'll tell you guys that.
Okay.
But we're in
Algiers. Okay. I do some teaching too, so I already know. Like, I do a lot of substitute teaching, and so I'm not gonna name the name of the school, but basically, it's just, like just really horrible. It was like a lower income, like kids school, or like no, renewed school, and it was uptown. I know. And yeah, I don't know. They treated those poor kids like crap. They were always bringing in like supervision people to come and drag them out. Like, yeah, they're black. They're all white teachers. I was one of the only black teachers that was a substitute. I was like, there's something wrong with this. But,